Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 4th of January, these are our main stories. In the US, the Republican Kevin McCarthy has failed several times to get the votes he needs to become Speaker of the House of Representatives. The founder of the failed cryptocurrency firm FTX has pleaded not guilty to fraud charges in a US court. 75 years after docking at Tilbury, we look back at the arrival of West Indians on the Windrush.
They came with great and good intentions. Part of that intention was actually about contributing to rebuilding Britain.
Also in this podcast, widespread condemnation of the controversial visit by Israel's new far-right security minister to Al-Aqsa compound in Jerusalem. And in Brazil, thousands bade farewell to the legendary footballer Pelé for the last time.
This is a day of mourning, but it's also one of celebration. Brazilians wanting to send off their king of football, and they're doing it in style.
We begin in the United States, where the House of Representatives is currently in deadlock over who should be its new speaker. The Republican Party won control of the House at the midterm elections, and it had been thought the job would go automatically to Kevin McCarthy, who's been minority leader for the past 4 years. But several of his own party have refused to back him, and as we record this podcast, it appears he has now failed to get the necessary 218 votes in three rounds of ballots. Before the vote, he told reporters he was determined to keep going until he won.
I will always fight to put the American people first, not a few individuals that want something for themselves. So we may have a battle on the floor, but the battle is for the conference and the country, and that's fine with me.
The Republican representative for Florida, Matt Gaetz, is one of those voting against Mr. McCarthy.
Those of us who will not be voting for Kevin McCarthy today take no joy in this discomfort that this moment has brought. But if you want to drain the swamp, you cannot put the biggest alligator in charge of the exercise.
It's the first time since 1923 that a nominee hasn't succeeded on an initial ballot. Shortly before recording this podcast, I spoke to Peter Bowes in the US to get the latest.
It isn't looking good for him, and with this latest vote, now the third round, he's actually losing support. In the first two rounds, 19 members of his party opposed his election as Speaker. He's lost again in this third round, 20 Republicans voting against him. He is a polarising figure in this country, but as the events of today show, he is someone that his own party, the Republicans, just seem unable to rally around. And you're right, it is the first time in a century that a speaker hasn't been elected in the opening round of voting. So we're in uncharted territory, at least in the modern world. And this is what's so fascinating. There's nothing in the mood music that suggests he is about to bounce back. One Republican, Bob Good, has said that members who oppose Mr. McCarthy will never back down.
So is there anything he can offer them in order to win this?
Well, he has vowed to fight on even if he doesn't win immediately. He's already made concessions to those in his party who've expressed doubts about him. He's been talking to them for the past few weeks, concessions such as a controversial change in the House rules that would make it easier to force a vote to remove a speaker in the future. That in itself would weaken his position as speaker if elected. Other discussions have centred around the roles which fellow members of Congress and the Republican side would take. And it's difficult to see what else he could say to win over those who are still opposing him if they haven't already been convinced. So what it will potentially take is for another candidate to come forward, described by one Republican as a reluctant warrior. The person currently standing in his way is Jim Jordan, representative from Ohio, a long-standing supporter of Donald Trump. But if Kevin McCarthy were to stand down, all of that could change and another candidate could emerge.
And how important is this role, the role of Speaker?
Crucially important, the Speaker is second in line to the presidency after Kamala Harris, the Vice President. The Speaker plays a pivotal role in the House. And crucially, right now, nothing can happen until the role is filled, so members can't be sworn in for the new session of Congress. There could be absolutely no work done in terms of the House's purpose in life, holding the purse strings of the country. No decisions can be made. The outgoing Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, this is interesting, she, of course, is there. She has cast her vote for Hakeem Jeffries, who is the Democratic candidate, who realistically, of course, never stands a real chance of becoming the Speaker.
Peter Bowes. The disgraced crypto executive Sam Bankman-Fried has pleaded not guilty to fraud and other charges at his arraignment in a Manhattan federal court. He's accused of organising one of the biggest financial frauds in American history. The BBC's North America business correspondent Michelle Fleury has the latest from New York.
Sam Bankman-Fried arrived at Manhattan Federal Court for the second time since he was extradited from the Bahamas. Wearing a dark suit, the disgraced crypto executive entered a not guilty plea to charges he cheated investors and customers on his cryptocurrency trading platform, FTX.com. US prosecutors allege Mr. Bankman-Fried used FTX customer money to pay the debts and expenses of his hedge fund Alameda Research, and to make lavish real estate purchases and political donations. If found guilty, he faces up to 115 years in prison. In multiple interviews before his arrest, including with the BBC, Mr. Bankman-Fried denied looting customers' money, but admitted he wasn't as competent as he thought. Meanwhile, two senior FTX executives, Caroline Ellison and Gary Wang, have pleaded guilty to fraud charges, and both are cooperating with federal prosecutors.
Michelle Fleury. There's been widespread condemnation of a visit by Israel's new far-right security minister to Al-Aqsa compound in Jerusalem. The site is considered to be sacred to both Muslims and Jews. A Palestinian official said they would hold the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responsible for the visit by Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's long argued that Jews should be allowed to pray in the compound. Our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, Yulia Nail, explained the significance of the story to Evan Davis.
This is the holy site in Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem in the Old City, the third holiest site in Islam after Mecca and Medina, the most sacred place for Jews, believed by Jews to be the location of two biblical temples. But since the site was captured by Israel from Jordan in the 1967 Middle East War, they have kept a kind of status quo there, which has allowed only Muslim worship to be permitted. But at the same time, Jews have been allowed to go to visit. And in recent years, we've seen more and more Jewish visitors going to the site. The advice of the chief rabbinate in Israel, actually, is that Jews should not visit there for fear of stepping over the holiest of holies. And they say that Jews should pray at the holiest place where they're permitted to at the moment, at the Western Wall, which is below. But Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's the new national security minister, he is a vocal religious nationalist. He has said repeatedly he wants to allow Jews to pray on the Mount. There is no sign that he prayed there today. And actually, the coalition deals that set up the new government have ruled out any changes to what's known as the status quo. The Prime Minister's office even said this afternoon that the status quo had been untouched, but that hasn't stopped real fury from Palestinians and a lot of criticism of what happened today.
Yeah, well, take us through some of the reaction of allies.
Yeah, I mean, we have from experience how quickly events around Al-Aqsa Mosque can spiral into tensions. We saw that in May 2021 when there was violence between Israelis and Palestinians, but then that led to clashes at the site, and then very soon Hamas rockets being fired towards Jerusalem, a deadly 11-day conflict. We saw in 2000 that a visit by Ariel Sharon, who was then the opposition leader, was a trigger for the second Palestinian uprising or intifada. So international allies know very well how dangerous things can be when there are perceived changes to the status quo at Al-Aqsa Mosque. We've had from the US, Israel's most important allies, an insistence that there should be the preservation of the status quo. Actions that threaten that are unacceptable. The White House has said similar messages from the French, from the British, from the region, much stronger condemnation from Jordan, from Egypt and from the United Arab Emirates as well.
Yolande Nell. The British government is preparing to classify Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps as a terrorist organisation. The legal procedure means it would become a criminal offence to belong to the group or support its activities. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landill.
The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC as it's known, is one of the most powerful paramilitary groups in the Middle East. It holds vast political, military and economic sway in Iran and across the region. The UK has already imposed sanctions on the group for its role in suppressing anti-government protests. But now the Home Office is preparing to proscribe the IRGC, formally declaring it to be a terrorist organisation. This would make it a criminal offence to support the group in any way. Whitehall sources said the government was acting after intelligence chiefs warned of the growing threat from Iran to the UK. The proposal, first reported by the Daily Telegraph, would mark a hardening of Britain's position towards Iran and make reviving the moribund Iran nuclear talks even less likely. A Home Office spokesman said it did not comment on whether specific organisations were being considered for proscription.
James Landale. Health workers in China are continuing to battle a surge in cases of COVID. One senior doctor said on state television that 70% of the population of Shanghai, the financial hub city with more than 25 million, may now be infected. There are calls for the Chinese to release data about the spread of the disease. That's not been forthcoming. Instead, China has denounced the decision to impose restrictions on its citizens travelling abroad because of the rise in infections and has warned it might take reciprocal action. A foreign ministry spokesperson, Ma Ning, told reporters that restrictions were unreasonable.
We stand ready to work with the international community to enhance communication and fight the virus, but at the same time we find some countries' entry restrictions, targeting only China, lack scientific basis, and some excessive measures are simply unacceptable. We firmly reject actions that manipulate epidemic response measures for political purposes and will take countermeasures based on the principle of reciprocity.
Dr. Maria van Kerkhove is the technical lead on COVID-19 at the World Health Organization. Raza Iqbal asked her what she's learnt from China about where the surge is happening and what impact it will have.
So the virus is circulating around the country pretty intensively, and those numbers of high levels of cases are to be expected when you have measures that are lifted, like public health and social measures. So we expect that to continue across the country. What we want to look at more carefully is impact, which was the second part of your question. What number of those cases are requiring hospitalizations? How many of those hospitalizations are requiring advanced care? And is there any difference compared to what we've seen in previous waves? Now they're dealing with a significant wave of Omicron. Omicron is, on average, less severe compared to Delta, the last variant of concern that was circulating, but still causes the full spectrum of disease. So if you have huge numbers of cases, and remember, we're talking about a population of 1.4 billion, you will still see a significant number of hospitalizations. So what we want to ensure is that within the country that they have access to antivirals, therapeutics, so those cases don't progress to severe disease, and really critically across the country, increase vaccination coverage and particular boosting among high-risk groups.
In your view, how widespread is the use of the vaccine in the groups that are most vulnerable?
So they have a number of vaccines that they're using in China. Our critical question right now to China, and in fact, every single country right now, is what is the coverage in terms of two plus a third dose, and in some cases, a fourth dose among those who are most at risk, the over 60, over 70, over 80, immunocompromised, and health workers. So population level immunity from vaccination is increasing around the world, but in that highest risk group, it's not as high as we need it to be in every single country, including in China.
I wonder what it is that you think you can learn from the Chinese, given that they have recorded 22 deaths since December. They have clearly narrowed the criteria for classifying COVID deaths. What is it that they have told you, and what is your assessment?
The classification of deaths in China is quite narrow, and we have said this publicly a few times now. With such a narrow definition of a death due to COVID, that is undercounting how many deaths are likely occurring. If we just look at in other countries, the proportion of patients with COVID that have died, this number in China is a significant underrepresentation. So we've encouraged them to loosen that definition so that the deaths, the burden can be traced over time and that we can track this over time. You know, we don't want to see an all or nothing approach. You can't have nothing in place for COVID. This pandemic is still rampant, you know, around the world. And we need to see sort of a right sizing of that response. We're pleased to see adjustments of strategies, but they need to be constantly assessed. We need countries to be able to detect and report and not be penalized that. But this virus, you know, the subvariants that are detected in China are subvariants that have been detected elsewhere. And so the ability to stop this virus moving across borders is extremely difficult, if not impossible.
Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, the technical lead on COVID-19 at the World Health Organization. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
They googled her and discovered she was a multiple murderer who was only free because of a legal technicality. She's like getting on a plane. She's coming to stay with them and they don't know how do you bring it up.
How this true story inspired a new satirical play by the man behind the TV dramas Dracula and Sherlock. The Portuguese football star Cristiano Ronaldo has been unveiled at his new Saudi Arabian club Al Nassr, having passed his medical test on Tuesday. At a lavish ceremony at the stadium in Riyadh, the former Manchester United player said his work in Europe was done. Our sports news correspondent Laura Scott was watching.
When he signed for Al Nassr last week after his bitter exit from Old Trafford, Cristiano Ronaldo said he was eager to experience a new football league in a different country. He knows the standard of the Saudi Pro League pales in comparison to the Premier League, but if star treatment and a sky-high salary were his priorities, then he has those at his new club. It's reported that Ronaldo, who turns 38 next month, will be paid £175 million a year, which would make him the highest paid player in football history. He's been greeted with fanfare in the Middle East. Speaking after an elaborate music and light show to welcome him, Ronaldo was introduced as the world's greatest footballer. He said he felt so proud to be joining Al Nassr, who are top of the league, and explained why he'd made the move.
In Europe, my work, it's done. I won everything. I played the most important clubs in Europe. And for me now, it's a new challenge. I feel very, very happy and very proud.
Unsurprisingly, there was no reference to the early termination of his contract by Manchester United after an interview in which he criticised the club's manager, Erik ten Hag, nor how he was sidelined by Portugal at the World Cup. Instead, Ronaldo was keen to focus on what he said was a great opportunity and not the end of his football career. Not staying to answer questions from the media, Ronaldo then went out onto the pitch, once again wearing the number 7 shirt, but this time in the yellow and blue of Al Nassr.
Laura Scott. It was 75 years ago this year that a ship docked at Tilbury, bringing people from Jamaica to the UK and ending up giving its name to a generation of arrivals from the Caribbean.
The Empire Windrush brings to Britain 500 Jamaicans. Their spokesman sings his thanks to Britain.
Now, may I ask you your name?
Lord Kitchener.
Lord Kitchener. Now, I'm told that you are really the king of calypso singers. Is that right?
Yes, that's true.
Will you sing for us?
Right now.
Yes.
London is the place for me. London, this lovely city. You can go to France or America, India, Asia or Australia, but you must come back to London City.
The Windrush Commemoration Committee was appointed by the Prime Minister to advise on how best to create a permanent and fitting tribute to the Windrush generation and their descendants. The Right Reverend Rose Hudson Wilkin, Bishop of Dover, is on the panel, and her mother, her uncle and an aunt were all on that boat when it docked at Tilbury. And she spoke to Michelle Hussein.
They came with great and good intentions. Part of that intention was actually about contributing to rebuilding Britain. And the second part of that was actually about returning to Jamaica and building their homes and living their lives.
And you are now part of this committee. What is your own view of the right and the best way to commemorate the people of that time, your mother's generation, particularly because we know how some suffered in recent years when they were not able to prove their identity and their time in the UK to the authorities?
I must tell you that the committee has done its job. We were chaired by Baroness Fuella Benjamin. We commissioned that amazing memorial, which is based at Waterloo Station, memorializing all those who came. It is worth seeing. You know, so if you've not seen it, please do go and see it. We wanted something physical to mark what has not just the difficulties that we experience, but something that said, we came, we were here, we have contributed. And it is an amazing memorial.
The three figures standing together.
Yes.
The unfinished business is the compensation scheme, isn't it? I wonder if you also think that the best way to complete commemorations is to get through those applications, because it's about 60% of those who suffered through the Windrush scandal and have applied for compensation who have had a decision.
Yes, and a different committee was actually dealing with that. You're right, the reality is people lost their homes, their jobs, families, their dignity. People developed mental ill health as a result of those losses. Yes, they have to make sure they deal with the compensation scheme, although what could ever compensate people for all that they lost? As well as dealing with the financial side of things, I think something else which would be a greater thing to have achieved from this is if Britain could change the rhetoric around migration. That's what is needed in the long run, so we stop othering some people who are here or who come to this country. We are here and we keep coming because you first went there. And that's the connection. And we need to educate our nation with regards to the past and its direct impact on the present today.
The Right Reverend Rose Hudson Wilkin, Bishop of Dover, speaking there to Michelle Hussein. The Western Cape in South Africa may have the smallest of the world's six floral kingdoms, areas recognised for their distinctive plant life, but it contains 4% of the world's plant species, many of them rich in medicinal properties. They're increasingly being used to treat various ailments, including high blood pressure and diabetes, as well as some infections. The pharmaceutical industry has also started to use the extracts of plants like aloe and rooibos. Mohammed Ali reports from Cape Town on this growing industry.
I'm at Kirstenbosch National Botanic Gardens in Cape Town, and I can tell you the setting is magnificent. Behind me is the rear part of Table Mountain. I'm at a section of the gardens that's called the Useful Plants Garden. Now, the use of medicinal plants that grow only in Cape Town has become more prevalent in recent years as more research is done into their healing properties. One of the main researchers is Patrick Buick, Professor of Immunology at Stellenbosch University.
There are more various plants with medicinal properties in the Western Cape as part of the fynbos than there is anywhere else in the world. And I think as part of this research, we are discovering more and more novel molecules in natural sources, not only for treating, you know, antibiotic resistance bacteria, but plants with antiviral properties, especially my personal interest with immune modulatory properties.
While many of these plants, including buchu, rooibos, aloe, and dozens more, have been used for medicinal purposes for centuries by the indigenous Khoi and San communities, it's only over the past two decades that scientific research has proven its efficacy. Here's Professor Buick again.
There's been an awakening from the scientific fraternity to actually look at the medicinal properties and providing the scientific evidence for the efficacy. And I think that's the most exciting, and that is no longer empiric use of natural sources of these, you know, plants. We now have very strong scientific evidence for the efficacy, and I think that's the most exciting.
There's a lot of advantages of this plant.
Baron Salomo is a member of the Khoi community who have been using the rooibos plant not only for making a herbal tea, but also for medicinal purposes.
It also reminds me of my sister's grandchild to have a very high infection of eczema. Then I told her, Sissy, what's wrong with you? You know what my mom told us. Use the rooibos. And that was the end of the story. She bathed this kid in rooibos tea. She gave her rooibos tea to drink. That was the miracle of that healing.
I've come to the seaside village of Cork Bay. Behind me is the Indian Ocean. In front of me, some mountains. And with me as well, there are people regularly selling natural herbs.
My name is Jeffrey. It's the medicine for the people. It's ancient medicine, traditional. There's mountain garlic, good for high blood, low blood, cold, flu, fever. This honeybush is a nerve tea. It's called the bokbuchu. Get mountain celery for water extension, that one there.
It's ginger. Like a celery, but it's different to the ordinary celery.
Mountain one, yeah. Everything is from the mountain, so everything come natural.
As resistance to antibiotics continues to grow and an increasing body of scientific research highlights the efficacy of natural alternatives, the use of plant-based remedies is increasing, and they are also finding a place in the pharmaceutical industry.
Muhammad Ali, social media, as we all know, has its downsides, except, arguably, in one respect, the ability to unfriend someone. The Unfriend is the title of a new play here in London by the acclaimed award-winning TV dramatist Stephen Moffat, the man behind Sherlock, Dracula and, for a time, Doctor Who. Stephen's first play is a satire inspired by real life, and he spoke to Nick Robinson.
A friend of mine was on a cruise and he met a flamboyant American lady and he befriended her, as his wife did, and they said the traditional absolutely final goodbye of let's exchange email addresses, and she didn't get the point. And she emailed and said she was coming to stay for a while, which horrified them anyway because they'd have to resume conversation with a holiday friend. Who wants that? And they Googled her and discovered she was a multiple murderer who was only free because of a legal technicality. She's like getting on a plane. She's coming to stay with them and they don't know how to email her about this. How do you bring it up? Do you say, look, we draw the line at murdering an our spare room? What do you say? In real life, because real life is dull that way, they just emailed her and never heard from her again. But in the play, they email too late and she turns up and they go through British raptures of agony about how to bring up the fact that she's responsible for the death of the innocent. Well, and the kids are there in the same house.
This is the kind of equivalent of Don't Mention the War or Basil Fawlty. Yeah. It's like Don't Mention the Mass Murders.
That's right. It's about the absolute, you know, the exquisite agony of bringing up such a difficult subject. How do you do it?
And will you make it a wider point, Stephen? I've only read about it, as I say, but this is about Brits being polite to an American who's behaved extraordinarily badly. Maybe it's my obsession with politics, but is there a wider point you're making it?
I wouldn't like to think I was saying that all Americans are murderers. I think that's an overstatement. I realise they have a crime.
No, I said it was. I said it was your first play.
Yeah.
What are the challenges for someone who's a master of screenwriting for turning your hand to writing? Or is it just another place to do it?
Well, I mean, there's a set of limitations that are different. You know, longer scenes, scene changes have to be thought about. You have to get people on and off the stage, which you don't really have to do in television. But to be honest, there's always a set of restrictions. If you're doing Doctor Who, there's only ever three monsters and only one of them can take their helmet off. You know, you sort of know that. So it's just a different bunch of restrictions. I love doing it, I've got to say. I absolutely loved it.
But what about sitting in the back on the first day there's an audience, the first night? Is that agony, Ryan?
Well, but that's the nice thing, too. I mean, it's terrifying because there might be deathly silence, and that is awful. But if there is laughter, it doesn't matter what any critic says should they give you a bad review. If you get laughter on the night, it was funny. That's definitive. So I love that. When you make a TV show, you know what it's like. You wait a month and they show you a graph and try to explain, nodding enthusiastically, that means it was a hit. And these days you haven't a clue. But in the theatre, you know instantly.
Stephen Moffat, writer of The Unfriend, speaking there to Nick Robinson. And we end in the port city of Santos in southeastern Brazil, where thousands of people have been paying their last respects to Pelé. His old club in that city says that more than 230,000 people viewed the sporting legend's open casket ahead of the funeral procession, which passed by the house where his 100-year-old mother, Celeste Arantes, still lives. Let's hear more about those events in Santos, starting with our correspondent, Katie Watson.
This is a day of mourning, but it's also one of celebration. Brazilians wanting to send off their king of football, and they're doing it in style.
Brazilian most known person around the world, you know, Pelé is money, you know. How many times I got in places in the United States and stuff just because I was Brazilian, just because people knew Pelé.
He's the number one ambassador of this country in the world, in my opinion. So if you travel abroad and you talk about Brazil, the first word you see coming back is, you are from the Pelé's country.
We grew up with him. Especially the streets that I grew up, he used to go to the supermarket. Every day I say hello to Pelé. That was normal for us.
Pelé was a huge soccer player. Here in Brazil, we love soccer. But he was also a huge human being. He supported a hospital in our city called Hospital Pequeno Príncipe. He donated a lot of money to research, and that's why we are here today.
Brazilians paying tribute to the sporting icon, Pelé. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.